From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Olsher, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, guns, crack, and crime. I'll talk with criminologist Richard T. Wright about how crack has changed the nature of crime and how the decline of crack use has affected the drop in the crime rate. Wright did fieldwork in St. Louis, where he teaches. He's also the co-author of Armed Robbers in Action, Stick-Ups in Street Culture. Also, we'll meet Aaron Sorkin, the creator of the new critically praised TV show Sports Night. It's a show about sports that really has nothing to do with sports. This is Sorkin's first foray into television. Before that, he wrote the films A Few Good Men and The American President. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate say they'll try again tomorrow to reach a bipartisan agreement on how to conduct the impeachment trial of President Clinton. Majority Leader Trent Lott and Minority Leader Tom Daschle emerged from a long day of discussions to tell reporters they've discovered some misunderstandings and that the two sides may be closer to agreement than they thought. First Lott, then Daschle said they'll consider the needs of House impeachment managers and the White House, but reserve judgment for themselves.
The House managers have a right to know what's going on or to express what their needs are on both sides. In the end, this is a Senate trial, and the Senate has to decide how to proceed and what the rules will be. But I think it's fair that we at least keep them informed without having them try to dictate either side.
I agree completely with what Senator Lott has just noted. The Senate must stay in control of this process. We have to take into account the concerns and the needs of both the House and the White House, but ultimately it's our decision.
Senators from both sides will meet in the morning for discussions with a vote on procedures tentatively set for the afternoon. A grand jury investigating sexual misconduct allegations against President Clinton has indicted a witness on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. The indictment was brought by independent counsel Kenneth Starr against Julie Hyatt Steele of Richmond, Virginia, a former friend of Kathleen Willey. Willey, a former White House volunteer, testified that the president made an unwanted sexual advance to her. Steele later cast doubt on Willey's testimony, filing an affidavit that said Willey never told her about the alleged advance, as she had claimed. National Public Radio has learned that Congress may investigate allegations of bribery and influence peddling involving the selection of Salt Lake City as host of the 2002 Olympics. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
A congressional investigation would be the fifth inquiry into allegations that Salt Lake Olympic organizers use college scholarships, lavish gifts, and free medical care to win votes from members of the International Olympic Committee. NPR has learned that Arizona Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, is considering Senate hearings on the scandal. A spokeswoman describes McCain as most concerned about the bribery allegations. She says Senate hearings would be based on the findings of a U.S. Olympic Committee investigation, which is scheduled for completion by the end of next month. Congress gives the USOC exclusive authority and responsibility for Olympic bidding and Olympic Games in the United States. Salt Lake Olympic organizers have said they'll cooperate with any and all investigations. I'm Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
And this is NPR News in Washington. Fighting shook the capital of Sierra Leone today as rebels captured portions of Freetown and set whole neighborhoods on fire. Witnesses said machine gun fire could be heard in the streets and black smoke rose over the burning parts of the city. The fighting appeared to continue despite an announcement from President Ahmed Kaba, who said that he'd agreed to a ceasefire with jailed rebel leader Fode Sanko. The rebels were reported to be using civilians as human shields in fighting with government troops and a West African peacekeeping force led by Nigerian soldiers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta report 8 people have died from a bacterial outbreak from contaminated meat. The outbreak has affected people in 11 states since last August. From Atlanta, NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The CDC confirmed that 6 adults have died and 2 pregnant women had miscarriages between August and December of last year after eating meat contaminated with a rare strain of bacterium known as Listeria. The outbreak has been linked to the Bilmar processing plant in Zeeland, Michigan, which produces hot dogs and other deli meats. The manufacturer, a subsidiary of Sara Lee, voluntarily recalled certain lots of the meat. The CDC then found the strain of Listeria in open and unopened packages of hot dogs. A different strain of the bacteria was also found in packs of deli meats. A spokesman for the CDC says the incubation period for the illness is 3 weeks or longer, and the agency cautions consumers who may still have the meats that they should return or discard them. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
The Dow Industrials lost 7 points today to close at 9,537. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, working to make the arts and culture an active part of people's everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Olscher, NPR cultural correspondent, sitting in for Terry Gross. Every year at the end of December, the Justice Department puts out a report called the National Crime Victimization Survey. And last month, as it has for 7 straight years, the government reported that certain kinds of crime are plummeting. Remarkably so, in some cases. Violent crime is down to where it was 25 years ago. Youth homicides are nearly half of what they were in the mid-80s. In 1997 alone, robbery dropped 17%. This trend reverses a surge in violent crime that started in 1985. While various theories are given for why the crime rate is dropping, like tougher policing and prison sentences, the strong economy, one reason stands out in particular, and it has to do with the decline in crack use. The growing consensus on the relationship between crack use and the crime rate was reinforced for my guest, Richard T. Wright, who went beyond the statistics and onto the streets to get a firsthand look at violent crime in St. Louis. Wright, who teaches criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, went out with his colleague Scott Decker and interviewed burglars and armed robbers who were still active criminals. Their most recent book is called Armed Robbers in Action. You describe this scene in St. Louis where a unique confluence of things happened, and this is something that happened in other cities around the country, where you have guns and crack and crime all coming together to form this almost new scenes, new situations, something that hadn't happened before, that had an effect on the economy and even changed the nature of crime. Can you explain, for example, why this led to a rise in robbery versus burglary? And first, I guess you need to explain the difference technically between the two.
Yeah. Well, burglary, of course, involves breaking into a house or a shop or something else and stealing goods without the resident's presence, certainly without confronting those who are inside, whereas robbery involves the taking of money or goods by force or threat of force. It's a much more direct kind of a crime. Burglary's been falling for a long time, and it has continued. It was falling even during the increase in violent crime. But what you see is that with the introduction of crack cocaine, and in cities where crack cocaine was introduced, you saw an accelerated decline of burglary in most cases and a steep increase in robbery. And what I think was going on there is this. The introduction of crack cocaine meant that a lot of people got involved. A lot of people got involved with it, and all of a sudden they were, selling everything they had to buy the drug. And you can see in neighborhoods that were rife with crack cocaine, you can see that the price of goods on the black market just plummeted. So that, selling something like a video cassette recorder would net you $25 or $30 at best in many of these neighborhoods.
Wait, I'm not sure why that happened. Explain why the price dropped.
The price dropped because it was simply supply and demand. There were so many people selling so much of their stuff to support their drug habits in these neighborhoods that the price for hot goods simply plummeted. The people who were buying them had too many VCRs. They weren't worth that much to them anymore. They just weren't scarce. And if you look at what really has happened to the price of goods in the black market, there has been a dramatic decline. That decline was brought about by crack cocaine because so many people were selling goods to support their habits. And that really destroyed the black market or the informal economy that characterized some of these high crime neighborhoods. And as a result, people moved out of burglary because it was no longer lucrative for them. It simply was not a lucrative crime. You could steal a VCR, but it was going to get you $30. To do that, you had to break into a house, you had to carry it, you had to find a fence, then you could go and get your drugs. And that was not an attractive crime. It simply took too long and didn't net enough cash. Whereas robbery nets cash directly.
And aging, right? That has something to do with it as well. I mean, people grow out of the age where burglary is something that they do.
Well, if you're going to take up robbery, you have to be able to stomach the violence. And it is not a crime for everybody. Robbers do tend to be somewhat older than burglars. And most of the robbers that we've talked to started out either selling drugs or committing burglary. But it's important to remember that only a fraction of people who get involved in those two crimes ever go on to robbery, because to commit a robbery, you have to be able to create a convincing illusion of toughness. And not everyone's capable of doing that.
Even if you're not going to follow through, you have to make your victim believe that you have what it takes to do that.
Absolutely. Particularly in the neighborhoods where these guys live and ply their trades. I mean, these are tough neighborhoods. And if you're going to rob somebody, you have to be able to convey the sense that you mean business. We talk in the book about creating the illusion of impending death. That's not an easy illusion to create.
How often do these robberies go bad?
Robberies don't go bad very often. If by bad you mean how often does the offender end up following through on shooting the person or stab them or do something like this, not very often. Offenders don't want to harm their victims by and large because, well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, that brings heat. They don't really want to have the authorities looking for them. So they really don't want to harm the victim substantially. So they're much more, if the victim resists, they're much more likely to resort to sort of non-lethal force. You see, what they're really trying to do is create the illusion of death. And they want to create that illusion in such a way that it extends beyond the robbery itself so that the victim will be loath even to report the crime for fear that the offender will come back and get them. And if they harm them substantially, they're going to have to that's going to come to somebody's attention. And they just as soon not have that occur. Now, if you talk to robbers, like we've talked to them, you'll find that virtually every one of them will tell you about people who've said, you can't have my money. And in those cases, the offenders will typically respond with, like I say, non-lethal force. If they can, they'll perhaps hit them or rough them up otherwise. Some of them will simply run off. Nevertheless, we always recommend that if confronted, one cooperate.
You've collected some amazing stories from your research. I think of a couple in particular. One involves a robber who was afraid to use a knife. I guess that was all he had, right? But he was using a knife knowing that it was a very risky situation to be putting himself into.
Yeah, I remember interviewing this guy quite well. We were talking, and he was suggesting that he had sold his gun because he was really desperate for drugs, and in a state of desperation, he'd sold his gun for really a very small amount of money. I can't remember how much. I think it was about $50. And consequently, he was relying on a knife to commit his robberies, and he was suggesting that, you know, this is really a very bad weapon to use in a robbery because anything can go wrong. Someone could grab the knife from me and, you know, just anything could happen. He really, it caused him to need to get too close to his victims. He really didn't like it at all. We finished the interview and within 6 hours, he was lying dead. He had tried to rob, he'd left our interview. He'd gone out a few hours later and tried to rob a woman. She'd grabbed the knife from him and stuck it through his heart.
My guest is Richard T. Wright. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with criminologist Richard T. Wright about the link between violent crime and crack. Why is crack use declining?
It was always a one-generation drug. Shortly after its introduction, it very quickly acquired a very bad reputation on the streets. It radiated out a little bit into the suburbs, but not very much. It caused real devastation in the neighborhoods where it got established. And people saw this kind of human misery that it had caused were extremely put off by it. People selling everything they had, becoming very emaciated, doing all kinds of degrading things. And they were simply, and people observing that simply weren't attracted to it. And so it just didn't develop a good reputation.
There's also, though, some relationship between the drug itself and the nature of the crime associated with it, right? You use a phrase even, the pharmacology of crime.
Well, crack is a binge type of drug, and so that when people, for example, heroin is used, and it's used once, and then it's several hours before it's likely to be used again. Whereas crack cocaine, the high lasts a very few minutes. People have a tendency to get caught up in cycles of use, very intense cycles of use. Any one individual rock of crack cocaine is very inexpensive, but in the aggregate, it can become very expensive. So people use one rock that causes them to want to use an additional rock, use yet another, and use yet another. They get caught up in these cycles of use. And, I mean, you got to remember, these highs are lasting literally minutes. And so people who are desperate for another hit or another high don't they feel this intense pressure to want to get more money to sustain that use. And that they don't have a long time to plan out some kind of an offense. So they're likely going to do something quite impulsive.
Whereas a drug such as marijuana brings about a whole different mood and a whole different sensation that not only probably wouldn't lead to crime, inactivity is more likely to result from something like marijuana, right?
Yeah, well, of course, it's a very different kind of a drug, a much milder drug, for one thing, and a much more sedating drug than something like crack cocaine, which causes people to be very hyperactive, somewhat suspicious, edgy. I mean, certainly very different kinds of drugs. And heroin, of course, also a drug that's it's a central nervous system depressant, and so causes people to nod off and be a lot, also it's just a very long-lasting drug, so people don't have this same sort of desperation to keep a high going.
So heroin and marijuana use are on the rise, crack use is declining, and as a result, we see a major shift in crime in America.
I think so. I mean, I think that we don't want to suggest that police activity didn't have anything to do with this. I think it did. The police, of course, certainly targeted crack sets very substantially. If you look at many of the people who are in prison, you'll find they're there on crack-related offenses. So they certainly had something to do with the decline in crack use. And I think that, you know, that's the major way in which the police had an impact on bringing about the crime decline. And I wouldn't want to suggest that they didn't have any role in that. They certainly did. But it was somewhat indirect in the sense that they targeted crack cocaine, and that the decline in crack use then went on to lead to a decrease in violent crime.
You also, in your book, Armed Robbers in Action, talk about another surprising influence of the credit card on street crime.
Well, what we suggest in that book is that as the economy changes, as we move more and more away from the use of cash, that's likely going to have an impact on robbery rates, because credit cards essentially, they have to be converted to cash before they're useful for offenders' purposes, because offenders want money to get drugs, and you're not going to buy drugs with a credit card. And so as we become more and more and more a cashless economy, it's hard for me to imagine how robbery will continue to be attractive to these offenders, because it simply won't give them what they need, cash. It's also hard for me to imagine how in a wholly cashless economy one would actually sustain a drug economy. I mean, how do you import drugs into a country without cash in suitcases? It's hard for me to see quite how that's going to happen.
I'm talking with criminologist Richard T. Wright of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. So you went to the streets and talked to people. How did you find them?
We found them through, with the help of people who had various contacts in the community. We had a street ethnographer, an individual who had been shot and paralyzed in a gangland-style execution attempt, he lived in the neighborhood and knew many people who were involved in crime. And he started off by approaching his friends and asking them to introduce him to people. We then asked them to introduce us to others. And so gradually we made an entree into these neighborhoods, and in fact ultimately became quite well known there, so that making contacts was quite easy.
How do you build trust, though, in a situation like that where you're coming in from the outside and asking them to talk about things for which they should be incarcerated?
Criminals aren't famous for being all that cautious, actually, and they were really quite open about their activities with us quite quickly, and surprisingly so. I think that it's almost a middle-class bias to assume that criminals are going to be all that reluctant to talk about what they're doing. A major way in which they get caught by the police is because they can't keep their mouths shut.
Hmm. When you spend time talking to criminals, active criminals on the street, as opposed to those who had already been put in prison, I wonder if they expressed remorse for what they had done.
Very little, actually. The majority of them said that they didn't feel sorry for their victims much at all. They justified that in a variety of ways. A lot of them said things like, well, they wouldn't feel sorry for me, so why should I feel sorry for them? Or, I was robbed, so why shouldn't I rob somebody else? Now, I'm not suggesting that the logic is great here, but these are the sorts of justifications that they fell back on. Now, in cases, many of these people victimized other criminals, and in those cases, they felt like they were actually doing society a favor by, for example, when they'd rob a drug dealer, they'd say, hey, you know, I just took some money and drugs off the street. So I've actually done everybody a favor by doing that. These really are more justifications than anything else, but really, the majority of the offenders did not express much guilt. Some of them did, particularly if they had hurt someone in the past. They felt guilty about that, but the vast majority didn't. They were busy feeling sorry for themselves and their own circumstances.
I wonder if there are any other stories that you can tell that surprised you, that flew in the face of the conventional wisdom about the nature of street crime?
Well, one of them was very interesting, I think, in one sense. We had arranged to interview an offender. We drove up to do our interview only to find him busily engaged in selling drugs. What was surprising about that is that he immediately jumped into the car, and that really surprised us, because we thought, you know, this guy's not going to come out and do an interview with us when he's busy selling drugs. And he said to us, well, no, I promised you I was going to do this. This is an obligation I have. And so let's go and do this. And that really surprised us. I mean, I think we were also surprised, you know.
Wait, can I just stop you for a second?
Sure.
You actually witnessed this crime taking place. This was an instance where you saw it happening.
Well, he was standing there. We didn't see him actually selling, you know, we didn't see him actually transacting business, but that's what he was certainly doing, standing there on the street corner.
Did you feel any obligation to report him or any other criminals you witnessed in the act of committing crimes?
The police are really quite good at what they do. They don't need our help to solve these crimes. Certainly, it's a real concern when you're out there. You know, you're really living in this kind of world of real emotional conflict and all the time. But the fact remains that if you actually were to turn in one of these people, we'd never learn anything about the nature of street crime. All of our avenues of information would dry up immediately. And so it's a conflict. You're always feeling like, gee, you know, it's really terrible stuff they're doing, and there's no doubt about that. And I didn't like them very much as individuals, usually. There were a few that I got along with reasonably well. But nevertheless, I felt like it was important to really understand what was going on in the streets, and I didn't see any other way to do it. But again, information about crime has been obtained from criminals for years from law enforcement authorities, who are also well aware that these people are involved in activities they shouldn't be involved in. And that's simply part of understanding what's really going on the streets. It's simply a necessary part of the ultimate goal of controlling crime.
Right. So if you believe in a higher purpose of doing something about crime, then I guess there are decisions you have to make along the way that, while in the short term may seem amoral, are in fact necessary means to an end.
You do struggle with yourself all the time when you're on the streets, making all kinds of extremely difficult decisions. And they're not comfortable. I have to say that, honestly. You have sleepless nights. There's no doubt about it. But it's necessary work. It's as simple as that.
Can you give me an example of a moment where you felt you really had to do a lot of soul-searching to get through a moral dilemma?
Well, I think that there's just no separating it out and talking about one particular instance. When you do this kind of work, you live with that, and it's you're always trying to make sure that you don't have foreknowledge of crimes, you restrict your inquiries to past offenses, all those kinds of things. But on the streets, that's a very difficult guideline to follow, because offenders are very inclined to want to talk about the future, to want to talk about things that are going to happen. And you have to constantly remind them these are not things that you want to talk about with them.
Because if you did know, then you would feel even more compelled to do something about it.
Certainly, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Richard Wright, thank you very much.
Sure.
Richard T. Wright is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's co-author of the book Armed Robbers in Action. I'm Dean Ulsher, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the latest new TV show about a TV show is called Sports Night. I'll talk with Aaron Sorkin, the show's creator. Sorkin also wrote the films A Few Good Men and The American President. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Olsher, and this is a clip from what many critics think is the best new TV show of the year.
Casey?
Yeah?
I made a decision.
What is it?
It's time.
It is?
It's time.
Natalie?
It's absolutely time.
We've been having some very bizarre computer problems. Have you noticed that? The LCY's been getting numbers wrong.
What do you need?
Messersmith won the gold medal in the pole vault with a leap of 238 feet, 6 inches.
That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, it lacks a ring of truth, yes.
238 feet, 6 inches in the pole vault. That'd be a record, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Elliot!
Why are you staring at me?
Because it's time.
It's not time.
It is time. It's past time.
It's not past time.
It's well past time. You need to start meeting women.
I've met many women.
No, you haven't. No, you haven't met many women. That's why I'm here.
Oh, boy, I like the sound of this.
You got married at 23 to a woman you met when you were 19.
I know. I'm there.
So you agree?
What?
You agree it's time.
You said it was past time.
Well, it is past time.
I'm screwed.
But I'm going to help you out.
Oh, thank God for that, Danny. Thank God for you.
Thank God indeed.
Indeed I do.
Do you know why I can help you out?
Why?
Because there's still time.
60 seconds to BTR, 2 minutes live.
Loading effects.
Every Tuesday night at 9:30, ABC airs a TV show called Sports Night about a fictional TV show called Sports Night. The show within the show is an ESPN-style sports news program, and the real-life show is a half hour that blends elements of sitcoms and TV drama. Aaron Sorkin, who wrote the screenplays for the films A Few Good Men, The American President, and Malice, is the creator of Sports Night. Thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Sports Night really stands out for a couple of reasons. One of them is your writing, and you write all of the scripts, and also some of the issues that you take on, which can be rather heavy for a half-hour TV show, traditionally speaking. And I have to say that I, for one, really don't care at all about sports, and yet I really like the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. A knowledge of or an appreciation of sports is, I think, no more required to enjoy Sports Night than a knowledge of or an appreciation of trauma surgery is required to enjoy ER, probably. You don't have to be a sports fan.
How did you hit on this idea for a show?
I had been a fan of SportsCenter on ESPN for a lot of years. In fact, there was about 2 years when I was holed up in a hotel room here in Los Angeles while I was writing the screenplay for The American President, and I didn't get out of the room much. To sort of keep me company while I was I'm from New York, so I didn't know many people out here, and to keep me company, I would have ESPN on in the room almost 24 hours. It'd be and I'd be watching SportsCenter. And these people on SportsCenter really became my friends in a pathetic kind of way. but I did think that the show was remarkably well produced, and I remember feeling like, boy, I wish I could go behind the scenes there. I bet I could have a great time there. I bet I could make friends. I bet I could meet a girlfriend there. And that's generally, you know, kind of a writer's cue for, you know, gee, it'd be nice to write something about that.
You know, I have to say, watching the show, one of the things that I find really refreshing about it, and I'm talking about your show, Sports Night, is that there seems to me to be a very minimal laugh track.
Yeah.
And yet there are critics who have referred to the laugh track as intrusive. Was there a big fight with ABC over this?
Yeah, the laugh track's been a bit of an issue since the moment we were born. Perhaps a bit too much of an issue. It was written about a lot. I and the other people who do the show felt that the laugh track was just wrong for the show. The style of writing is a little bit different than it is on other half hours. We don't necessarily lead to an obvious punch. A lot of it is more enjoyable than it is laugh out loud funny. So the march time rhythm of a laugh track was actually getting in our way, on top of which we all thought it was a little bit silly and maybe time not to do that anymore. But you got to remember that really the greatest asset of half-hour television, at any rate, is its familiarity. Half-hour television is something that you watch very passively. It's you do it while you're flipping through a magazine or talking on the telephone or cooking dinner or putting the kids to sleep. And in a lot of cases, that sound of the laugh track, the familiarity of the show, that it's a sitcom, that it's a half hour, helps a lot in getting the audience. And I think that our show, because it is a little bit different than other half hours, the concern on the part of the network, and it's a legitimate concern, was that let's try and create some touchstones for this show. Let's try and let people know that there's nothing to be afraid of here. There are more words in this show than in other half hours, but But look, it's funny. It's not good for you. This isn't eating your vegetables. And so that was really the kind of the genesis of the argument. Our laugh track is pretty toned down, and I do like to believe that it's inobtrusive.
Mm-hmm. This show has an ensemble cast, mm-hmm. and many, many of the great TV shows that are most memorable have also had ensemble casts. Sometimes they tend toward archetypes, and I wonder if that's been a temptation that you've had to face when you're writing these characters.
It's always a temptation when you're starting something from scratch, when there's just a blank piece of paper, to say, well, who do you got? You got the neat guy and you got the sloppy guy. You got the tall guy and the short guy. You got the gay guy and the straight guy. Let's say we need a dorky guy and we need a really uptight guy. And you want to do everything that you can to not do that. And one way to not do that is rather than, I think, tell an audience who a character is, if you show them what the character wants, if you're just a little subtler, if you realize that everybody can be smart and everybody can be stupid and everybody can be right and everybody can be wrong, then you'll be a little bit better off. And if you take advantage, I mean, one of the great things that you have in episodic television, I think, is time. If everybody will just agree to be patient, that we're not going to, in the pilot episode, we're not going to feel bound to say these are who these people are in 22 and a half minutes, that we're going to take much more time than that. And if you agree, as I say, that there are no, and I'm going to reference now just a classic comedy and one that I'm a big fan of, but there are no Ted Baxters on the show, then you're probably better off.
How do you go about deciding what to treat as a topic for the program?
That's an interesting question. What I don't do, or what I don't do often, is say, boy, you know, I feel very strongly about it. What I'll tell you what I don't do is I don't tend to take things off of yesterday's headlines. For one thing, yesterday's headlines will be 6 weeks ago's headlines by the time the show airs. Secondly, it also seems cheap. Oftentimes I'll take something off of page 23. I'll read about something and think, well, you know, that's interesting, and not quite enough was made out of that. And what if this had happened instead of that? That kind of thing. I am not. It's not my goal to necessarily say something with each and every episode. As I said, I'm not looking to teach anybody anything. Really, we're, you know, just we're kind of telling our lame jokes and doing our stories and trying to do them from a place of reality. As opposed to, again, a traditional half-hour place. You know, this isn't the first television show that's been done about a television show. There was a really good one done about a television show, Murphy Brown, which ran for 88 years or something, and it was great. But the success or failure of Murphy Brown, of that show, didn't depend on us thinking, on us believing, that that's really how 60 Minutes gets done. A show like that, a national news magazine show, is staffed by five people who have their meetings a little at a linoleum table in the lobby near the elevator. With Sports Night, because we want to tell all kinds of stories and in all kinds of ways, it all has to start from a place of reality, or the appearance of reality. You have to really buy that these guys are doing this show every night at 11 o'clock.
Right. Let's talk about some of the risks that this show faces. Let's put it this way. It's had a certain amount of difficulty finding an audience. And mm-hmm. I want to read to you what James Collins wrote in Time magazine about Sports Night. "This series represents the best opportunity in a long time for network comedy to evolve into something sharper and more interesting. If it fails, a highly possible outcome given its mediocre ratings, then the networks will be all the more wary of trying something novel. On the other hand, if the show succeeds, it might just revitalize a very tired form."
Well, an easing of the pressure is what we were looking for over at Sports Night, and James Collins provided it. That was a very flattering thing that he wrote about us. The whole piece was very flattering, and the idea that we could do something as huge as change television even a little bit, well, that's pretty high cotton. I can assure you, as flattering as that is, no one, least of all me, went into this with the thought of let's do something different. or let's change the old way that it was done. I'm really writing Sports Night exactly the way I've written everything else, the plays that I've written and the films that I've written. And what's so unusual is simply that it's half-hour television. That notwithstanding, I like the sound of what James Collins said.
But he also refers to what seems like the sword of Damocles hanging over your head. I mean, are you reading the Nielsen ratings every week, worried that, oh, my God, this might be it for us? We need to find some more viewers.
I will tell you honestly that our ratings, which I must say are now in this is week 13, broadcast week 13, have been climbing and climbing and climbing and are now on the they are respectable, we're going to call them, which means we get about 10 million people every Tuesday night watching the show. I have to tell you that for me, 10 million people is an enormous audience to play to every Tuesday night at 9:30. 10 million people, for instance, is 9 million people more than my play, A Few Good Men, played to in a year and a half on Broadway. The first night that the show was on the air, we premiered September 22nd, if that had been a movie opening that night, it would have been a $90 million opening. So the numbers in television are very strange. And my concern isn't so much that, oh, my God, if we don't get the viewers, we're going to get off the air. My concern is, gee, we've got 10 million people now. I'm not sure I like what we have to do to the show in order to get 12 million people.
Does that mean dumbing it down, making it more conventional TV?
I think that that's going to be the next argument that's going to take place, is really what I'm alluding to. And I'm of a belief that it absolutely does not mean dumbing down the show. I think that people in this country who watch television are a lot smarter than they tend to be given credit for.
My guest is Aaron Sorkin. He's the creator, executive producer, and writer of Sports Night. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Aaron Sorkin is the creator of the TV show Sports Night. He wrote the screenplays for the films Malice, The American President, and A Few Good Men, which means he's responsible for introducing this phrase into the popular culture.
You can't handle the truth!
Aaron Sorkin, what's it like to be the writer of a line like that, which has been taken over by people who are not actors?
Yeah, who knew? Who knew? Every once in a while, you'll see it on The Simpsons or something, and I remember watching the opening of the O.J. Simpson trial, and there were all sorts of pretrial motions flying back and forth. And everyone else in my family is a lawyer but me. My mother's a school teacher, but my father is an attorney, and my sister is an attorney, and my brother is an attorney. And somewhere in the pretrial motion phase of the O.J. Simpson trial, I think Johnny Cochran referenced the line. Judge Ito, it's like that movie, you can't handle the truth, and then Ito said, you know, yeah, but Nicholson was the bad guy in that movie. And my phone rang, and it was my sister, you know, just saying, 93 years of law school, and you're the one who gets quoted in the trial of the century.
You also wrote The American President, which mm-hmm. has Michael Douglas as a very human but still somewhat heroic chief executive of the United yeah. States. And I read in USA Today when the playwright Wendy Wasserstein came out of a screening, she said, it's a perfect example of what Hollywood wants in a president. It's what they thought they had elected in Clinton. Was she right?
That's interesting. I think that, first of all, I get a little nervous when anybody talks about Hollywood. I have to tell you, as if we all get together for meetings every third Thursday of the month and decide what it is we want and what it is we do. I could not tell you what Hollywood wants and doesn't want in a president. Hollywood had absolutely nothing to do with that movie. I wrote it all by myself. And the answer to Wendy's question is, of course. I wrote the kind of president I wish we had. Certainly one we thought we were getting when we voted for Bill Clinton.
I'm talking with Aaron Sorkin. He's the creator of Sports Night. I wonder what your week is like.
The week begins, it's hard to say when the week begins because the old one is still ending when the new one begins. But the week begins with a Monday morning with a table read of the script that I generally have finished writing on Sunday night. It's been sent out to everyone Sunday night. They've had a chance to read it through. And this table read is for people from the network and from the studio, as well as the department heads and the cast and I. And as soon as the table read is over, rehearsal begins. We rehearse for 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. Filming begins on Wednesday. We film Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Now, I'm always doing three things. I'm making this week's show while editing last week's show and writing next week's show. Is basically how it works. And I love this show so much. I just love my job. I really sprint to work every morning to get to work with these people. And it's like doing a new one-act play every week. You know, the big difference between what I'm doing now and writing movies is the immediacy of it. Three or four weeks after I've written a show, it'll be on the air. If I were writing a screenplay right now, I could write a joke today and wouldn't hear a laugh for 2 years. So it's really an adrenaline rush.
When it comes to the dialogue, you talk about the jargon and the illusion of reality, but even just in the writing of dialogue, it's so far from the way people really speak, and yet it does have that illusion. It feels more real than if you were in fact transcribing actual dialogue from people in real life.
That's right.
And it's very writerly dialogue.
Yeah, it's I'm going to accept that as a compliment. It's what it is. It's the way I write. It's not so much the way people speak, I think, as maybe the way people wish they spoke sometime. If I'm going to have a 2-minute conversation with my best friend, let me try scripting it, and it can be more interesting. There's a certain musicality to it. It's very, a lot of the show is very much about its own rhetoric. We try and strike the right balance in 22 minutes and 35 seconds. As I said, we have a lot more words per episode, I think, than some other shows do. It's the way I write.
It's a funny balance. Anytime you're trying to make a work of art, how much artifice do you use to create the sense of reality?
Yeah. Well, I become that's right. And I've enjoyed playing with that balance in the other things that I've written, which required that same. I mean, part of the fun of the American president was going to be the feeling of, boy, I feel like I'm inside the White House. And there's a cool conversation taking place that I don't get to see on CNN or hear about on NPR. And same thing with being in a Navy courtroom and in Malice. In Malice, I am also my friends know this about me. I will frequently, as far as the jargon is concerned, make things up, especially in a first draft. If I'm writing a first draft and I'm really just trying to get the sense of the scene down on paper and the sort of the verbal fireworks, really the rhythm and the music of it, I'm really not going to bother to. I wrote a scene that was cut from the film Malice, but it had been an opening scene in an operating room where the camera was just circling the doctors and the nurses standing around the operating table while instruments were being asked for and slapped into the surgeon's hand, and a lot of chrome and steel and this and that and suction and numbers going back and forth, and it was and the scene built and built and built, and it was terrific. But I was making up all this stuff in the scene, and finally, as the script went along, it was in production and brought in a technical supervisor, a trauma surgeon, and I was amazed to find out that one of the things I had done and this was right.
It's pretty scary when you think
of
it.
Yeah, it's very scary. yeah, it's the Benson clamp.
Aaron Sorkin is the creator, executive producer, and head writer of Sports Night.
Jeremy?
Yes?
Tell me the story so far in UCLA, Arizona.
The story, Dana, is shooting percentage and offensive glass. Last I checked, UCLA was 12 for 24 from the field, 1 for 6 at the stripe. Arizona's press forced 12 turnovers, which led to 15 points. The Cavs, needless to say, were dominant in the paint, and McDuffie's got 4 fouls. That is the story.
Jeremy?
Yes?
What's the score?
Wow.
Jeremy?
Devil's in the details.
Jeremy?
66-50, Arizona.
Thank you.
No problem.
Stand by audio, stand by VTR.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews rock and roots music from Colombia. This is Fresh Air. If the term world music means anything, it means music rooted in a culture and yet attuned to and excited by the sounds of other cultures. Music critic Milo Miles thinks Bloque from Colombia is a prime example of a great world music band.
When you find out a big pop star got his start as a hunk on a TV soap opera, like Colombia's Carlos Vives did, you have doubts about his talent. But Vives is more than a pinup who's wired for sound. He's got fabulous hair, great thighs, and a pretty okay voice. What put him over, though, was his dynamite backing band. And now they've split off and call themselves Bloque. The new frontman, who used to write songs for Vives, is Ivan Benavides, and he has no hair at all.
Fui perseguido, expulsado, repelido, repudiado, señalado y segregado por la buena sociedad. Yo fui tratado como si fuera un mantido y condenado sin derecho a un abogado, aunque nadie le haga mal. Yo y me han dejado con los colores cambiados y con los cables cruzados extraviados y eso no lo aguanto más.
Benavides is indeed a motor mouth, suited by nature for rap and for speak-singing lyrics about social and personal chaos held together with tricky beats. Bloque use a lot of regional rhythms from Colombia, and they make a point of identifying each one in concert. But it's the popping, funkified bass and the nimble, ferocious rock guitar of Ernesto Tato Ocampo that hook your attention, because Bloque uses them with the same passion and grace as their folk sources. In interviews, Benavides huffs and puffs about the cultural imperialism of Western pop, but this is a band who does a dang good Led Zeppelin cover. In other words, Bloque shows the dexterity and insouciance that world music fans hoped would transform pop just a few years ago. If you think infinite niche marketing is a dead end, the promise of world music was that one of its many, many styles would become the next big thing with American or British bands. It hasn't happened. New bands continue to recombine past Western pop in hopes of finding the magic formula in the rearview mirror, and now a lot of world music stars are recording bland versions of themselves for the Western market and only taking risks on albums released in their homeland. Loke will have none of it. The band pushing and raving behind him, Benavides has a first-rate central idea in his songs. A man, a love affair, even a whole country with a chaotic surface but spiritual roots that will save them, if the roots can be located. The problem is that chaos and laziness have their pleasures. Benavides has a dandy tune that could apply to Washington as much as Bogota. He suggests the usual corruption and failures just continue because innocents know nothing because they are too innocent. And culprits know nothing because they are too guilty.
Inocentes y los culpables no saben de nada porque son demasiado culpables. A los ricos no les afecta porque son demasiado ricos. A los pobres no les afecta porque son demasiado pobres. Ha sucedido.
Loke's self-titled debut is one of the year's finest world music records. But one major shortcoming is that it downplays the role of singer and Indian flute player Mite Montero. In concert, she bears down on her huge wooden flutes and flies through fancy phrases with as much fervor as guitarist Ocampo. Her relaxed, joyous vocals seem to offer the harmony Bloque searches for so nervously. Perhaps Mite Montero is the spiritual root that will save them.
Milo Miles is music editor at Soundstone.com. Fresh Air is produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. I'm Dean Olscher.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. And from Little Brown and Company, publishers of Peter Guralnick's follow-up to Last Train to Memphis, Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Dean Olscher. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from novelist Russell Banks. His novel Affliction has been made into a new film. Also, actor Nick Nolte. He stars in Affliction, as well as the new movie The Thin Red Line. Join us for the next Fresh Air.